Welcome to Chasing Encounters, a podcast about stories, languages, cultures, and identities. We highlight diversity and intersectionality in contemporary society through respectful and thought-provoking conversations. Hello, everybody. This is Yacid Ortega, and this is Chasing Encounters, your podcast. Today, we are recording season number five, episode number five. And today, we have the pleasure of having Jason Mitzel, right? Is that how I pronounce your last name?
Yes, Mitzel.
Mitzel. Thank you so much. Yeah, see, I always ask this question to my guests because, you know, this idea of names and last names is so difficult for a lot of people. And it's important when we open the spaces to folks to, you know, start these conversations. And it's funny because I was listening to the other ones, previous podcast episodes that I did in the past. And I always start with the name. But I think what a better way to start a conversation if it is not about who we are, where yeah. we're coming from, etc. And although I know you for a while from different online media, like probably Twitter and Facebook, from Scholars of Color and, you know, here and there. So I'm happy to have you here today with me and having a conversation. So because we don't know much about you, so we want to get started to please let us know a little bit about your ground, like personal, family, where you're coming from, your background, languages that you speak, family, relatives, anything that you want to share with us today.
Okay. Well, I guess one of the big things is I'm originally from the American South. So in some ways, I'm a true Southerner, and I was born in Georgia. So I lived there for, you know, a good chunk of my life. And so, of course, growing up in the American South, of course, you know, linguistically, I speak Black Southern American English and then dominant Southern American English also. Because as a Black person growing up in the American South, you've got to speak both varieties of English. And then, of course, as far as schooling, I did a lot of my primary and, you know, middle school and high school in Georgia. But then when I was in college, I actually went away and spent almost the next 20 years, so over half my life, living, studying, and working in Latin America. Okay. Especially living between Ecuador, Peru, and Venezuela.
Wow.
So that's why I sort of see myself as a sort of hybrid. And especially my Ecuadorian friends, they'll tell you, they're like, eres americano, pero no eres un americano de verdad. And I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, well, because like you're born in the U.S., but you know, you've been here so long that you're not 100% American anymore. You're this really funky mix, you know? And I sort of own that because I think once you live someplace for a long time, you do become this interesting mix. And so it really resonates with me whenever I've read the work of especially a lot of Chicana scholars, you know, that whole idea of ni de allí, ni de acá. So like, I'm not really from here nor from there, this sort of middle ground. So even linguistically, whenever I think of my languages in speaking Spanish, I always tell people, yes, I speak Spanish, but I speak a very Quitanian variety of Spanish. Because for almost 20 years, I lived for most of that time in Quito, which is in Ecuador. And so, you know, every country has their varieties and ways of speaking. So whenever I am in Quito, my friends are like, okay, yeah, I'll go to the coast of Guayaquil. And my friends on the coast are like, oye, eres muy serrano. You know, they're like, you're really from the highlands, aren't you? You know, and so linguistically, those things. And then even educationally, like I am very much first generation college goer. And so in my family, which is very interesting, at least for me, there are actually two of us with PhDs. Like I have a brother with a PhD, he's at Vanderbilt. And then there's me who now have my PhD. And then my two sisters, they both have their undergraduate degrees. And so in our family, our mother really emphasized education. But I always tell people, and for me, this is really important in who I am, is in the States, we have this whole idea of, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, do the work by yourselves. And I'm like, I didn't do that. No, I had people who opened doors for me. I had people who supported me. And so did I work hard? Yeah, we all work hard. But I think we have to sort of get out of the idea that we do this by ourselves. This is very much a community effort. And so I really see the degrees I have as a reflection of my communities and the support that I've always gotten from those communities.
Wow, Jason, thank you so much for that opening remarks for our episode today. And I think I want to reply to a couple of your comments that I found it very interesting. I think number one, you mentioned a couple of times, I am from the American South. And I don't hear many people saying that I am from the American South. And the first thing that came to my mind was like, are you talking about South America? And the reason why I said that is because I remember I lived in Chicago for 10 years, and then I was a Spanish teacher. And then I remember when I was teaching Spanish in one of the many classes that I was, in one of the classes, the students, I am from South America. Right. And one of the children raised their hand and they said, oh, so you mean you were born in Texas? And I said, no, in South America. And she said, yeah, well, you know, this is America. And in the South of America, it's Texas. And I say, and I have to pull out the map, the American continent map. And I started to explain where these things were from. And finally, they got it. And finally, one of them said, why don't you teach us geography instead of Spanish? And I was like, I wish I could be your geography teacher, because you will really learn a lot of things that you don't know.
Right.
And that got me to the second point in which you later you mentioned that you lived in South America actually for a while. And it was so interesting that you say, I am from the American South and I live in South America. So I found it like a really good play of words here. And I like that. And I also like the idea of you mentioning, you know, the idea of borderland, borders and not borders, that you are from here, but also not from there, and feeling that you are from different places, but not from here. And that's the feeling that a lot of us immigrants, probably refugees to North America, that's how they feel. Like they somehow feel they are here, but sometimes they don't belong. And because there is a lot of questioning right. of where you're coming from. And I love it that you started your presentation describing us where you are from. And I'm going to finish up this thought with what you mentioned, how you came to education. And one of the many reasons you came to education was because the community effort and your family. And I must agree with you that definitely education is so important in our lives and in the many of the people that I know, that community and family became important as we pave the future in education and as we become role models, is because our family and our communities have become role models. Now, that being said, I want us to guide us a little bit more, like now you're coming into education, what is important to you as a, I would say, as a scholar, as an educator, what is important to you in education and in research? Why not?
I guess everything I do, honestly, and I say I'm selfish, and I say that because I am, and I say that I'm selfish because everything I do really goes back to my family and really goes back to my son, because I have a 17-year-old son now. Mm-hmm. And when I look back to my family, I remember fondly, and sometimes not so fondly, conversation I had with my mom. My mother never finished high school, but she's one of the most skilled linguists that I know. She really knows how to examine what people are saying and even examine what people are not saying and how that also tells you something.
Right.
And so she was sort of like my first role model as a linguist, really looking at language and how language works. And even learning with her how to do what now in linguistics we call remixing. How am I using my languaging skills as a Black American? How am I using those languaging skills and mixing those with dominating American English in order to get what I want?
Right.
Get my needs met. And then I really look at my son, because my son was a huge impetus really to go back and to do my PhD. Because my son, he really looks at himself as Afro-Latine. Because, I mean, he was, of course, born in Ecuador. Lived there for most of his life until we moved here to the States. So he grew up speaking English and Spanish.
Right.
I have to be very clear, Southern American English, because he got that from me, you know, and then really speaking Quiteñan Spanish, because let me tell you, when he is in Quito, you hear the little upward lift of his voice.
Right.
You know, and then when we moved here to the States, that was the first time he really had to deal with opposition to his use of Spanish and even opposition to his variety of English.
Right.
And so we had lots of comments made toward him, and we had a conversation ourselves about how he identifies and what I want for him. And so my whole thing was, here I am as a person, at that time with my master's degree, years of experience teaching, what do I want for my son? I was like, you know what? I want my son to be valued for who he is ethnically, linguistically. And those two things sometimes don't always go together. Because there's a whole idea, of course, looking at like Nelson Flores's work and John Tenorosa's work with racial linguistics, and even looking at Kimberly Adelson Crump's work, she has something that's called language crit, or language critical race theory, and the whole idea of subject is seen and subject is heard. So a lot of times in schools, people would see my son, they're like, oh, he's a little black boy. But then he speaks Spanish, and they're like, uh-oh. What is he? Or he would speak English, and then there's some backlash and pushback about his English. So my whole thing was, I want to study languages, and I want to study, how do we make linguistics truly anti-racist? How do we move toward that? Because, and this is where my selfishness comes in, I want my son not to have to put up with things I had to put up with. I want him linguistically and educationally truly, is the boys talks about having all those doors open and not being despised for who he is, or at least for who people assume him to be by looking at him. And to me, language, it's sort of that portal, because language is one of the first things that people hear when they see you. And they will make judgments based on what they hear. And of course, that's through their filter. Right. And so my goal is, how do we break that filter? How do we break that sort of white gaze filter so that all of our children's, their languaging can be really valued? And, you know, I mean, I'm in a sort of a special place. I have a degree, not a lot of people who look like me have, and I've had opportunities that I've been supported in. So how can I be selfish and help my kid and then be like, hey, I'm being selfish and helping mine. Now I need to do my work and open some doors for other people also.
Right. No, definitely. I am so happy that you keep bringing back how you enter into this conversation through family concerns. And you just mentioned language as a portal, and everybody sees you is through this portal or through this window that sometimes you cannot deny. Right. So now, moving on to our topic for today, because I'm really interested in the work that you do and moving into the language education, and now specifically into the research that you have recently conducted, or you recently did, and now you are sort of mobilizing this knowledge. I would like to know more about the research that you've done respect to a cultural sustaining systemic functional linguistics praxis project that you were into a while ago, or it was not long ago though, right. But I want to hear more about all of these details about this research that you were into.
Well, with systemic functional linguistics, it is not only a theory of language, but it's also a methodology of language. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, Michael Holliday was really foundational in starting systemic functional linguistics. But something a lot of people don't think about is Hassan was also, I don't know if I want to call her the mother of SFL, because I think she's just so fundamental to the work. But her work also really looked at context of learning and use in context, and how languages are learned and how languages and languagers are seen.
Right.
And so I look at her work and Holiday's work, and it really forms this whole basis of how do you think about how language is dealt with power-wise between people, organizations. That's where the interpersonal part. And then the ideational part is, you know, how are some of the nuts and bolts sort of put together? And then when you also look at the other strata, if you're really looking at like the mode, how is language being expressed? And so it's very organized, which I need that. I like order in my life. So SFL gives you those order tools. And yet those tools have really been filtered through what Toni Morrison would talk about, a white gaze. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that gaze is there that you need to replicate narratives this way if you want them to be valued. You need to replicate a science report one certain way if you want it to be valued. If you want an argument to be valued, it has to go with this model. And my question is why? Mm-hmm. And that's for me where the culture sustaining work comes in.
Definitely.
Culture sustaining work brings in our knowledge. It brings in a valuing of who we are as people of color and our languaging, our literacies. And what it really does well, it doesn't tell us that we have to use our knowledges as people of color to get to, as a bridge, to get to sort of this quote unquote promised land of speaking white, writing white. No, it's telling us, you know what, you have these dominating ways of doing. There are also different cultural ways, whether it's Black American, whether it's Chicano, whatever, they're also as valuable. You know, it's not use the bridge to get someplace else. No, value it for itself. And to me, by bringing those worlds together, how do I use these structures to examine both of them? How do I use those structures to examine my Black American English that I use? Mm-hmm. How do I use those structures to sort of examine dominating American English? And then how do I deconstruct them and be critical about both of them?
Right.
And yet when I need it, and this for me is the whole thing, when I need it, how can I remix things to be effective for what I want? Not for an outside audience say, hey, you know what? If you want to write a really good narrative, you've got to write it this white way. And this is the only way. No. I can remix for my needs. And to me, when you teach kids that their languaging is valuable and beautiful for what it is, not as a bridge to something else, but it is important for what it is, and you're explicit about these dominating ways so they can be critical of them and understand how they're put together, then kids really have the tools that they need to do what they need with language. And to me, that's where, when you bring these two worlds together, to me, that's the power of it. Is there a value of both, a criticality of both? Because even as like Samuel Lean would probably tell you, or even the Django Paris, you know, I mean, people are like, rap, rap, rap. We're going to use rap to teach kids this and that. And at times, that rap is used as a bridge. And my thing is like, no, why are you using it as a bridge? Why is it valuable for itself?
Right.
And then even within rap, are there things that are problematic? There are. There's homophobia sometimes, there's sexism, there can be colorism. So we also need to learn to be critical of who we are and look at all those isms. And for me, the culture saying sustainable functional linguistics brings those two worlds together.
Yeah.
And the other thing I love about it is it also has a valuing of our ways of knowing. So that's why I really bring in with CSSFL use of testimonials and prácticas. Because those are ways of knowing of our communities. And so that's one of my new things I'm really working on is how do we sort of break down linguistics so that linguistics now is a field where non-Western, non-white ways of knowing are truly valued. And that we as users of those are also valued and we can have them held up as legitimate. So not trying to make sure other people buy into us, but we ourselves are holding these up is valuable.
But see, I think I agree with you. I think we should. I mean, when I say we is people of color, scholars of color, we should start valuing the work that we do even more. And that's why when you speak, I believe that asserting our identities, we are people of color. It's important to bring those words together, as you say, in order to counter this white narrative that you were mentioning. And that's why you, in the work that you do, and I want you to probably elaborate a little bit more on the methodology that you use. I know you mentioned the testimonials and the pláticas as a good way to help us to know a little bit more about the ways of knowing that typically people don't talk about. So in this next part of our conversation, I want you to describe and tell the audience, what is testimonials and why is so important to help us assert our identities as people of color or Latinx or Latine?
Well, for me, testimonials, and I draw a lot on the work of Chicano feminist scholars, in particular, a lot of the work of Judith Flores Carmona, who for me, she's one of my sheroes. Man, I love her work and her whole group. I love what they do. And when you sort of look at testimonials, testimonials in part are very similar to counter stories or counter narratives. So there are these ways of knowing that individuals from racialized, minoritized communities, their ways of really talking about their experiences and how those experiences in many cases are sort of counter to these sort of hegemonic narratives, these hegemonic ways of knowing in the world. And even though they're individual, they're also communal at the same time. Because even though I'm talking about the way, for example, the way I was brought up and learning how to navigate in a racist society, that also is really reflective of the experience of my community. Because none of us are sort of an island, you know, there's no one around us. We come from a place. So our stories also represent facets of where we're coming from. So those testimonies really speak to my experience, but also speak to my community's experience.
Right.
Is that in doing that work, one of the other things that's really important is that testimonials don't only talk about the struggles that people have gone through. Testimonials also talk about the joys. Because I think a lot of times we get so caught up in, oh my God, all the horrible things. But if you even reflect back on during the time of enslavement, there were enslaved people who loved, who were loved. And yes, did they fight? Oh my God, yes, they did fight for their freedom and for the languages to be valued, but they also loved and they were happy. Now, I'm not saying they're happy with the enslavement part, don't get me wrong, but they were happy, you know? And the same thing I find with testimonials, it's both of those, it's both and. It's that really that fight against and pushing back against these hegemonic narratives, these deficit ways of doing, but also there's these moments of joy and pleasure that Wong and Pena talk about that we can also use, and I try to use in my work to really help youth know that use your voice, because all youth have voices, but use your voice to really talk about your community, talk about what you need, but also talk about your joys, your pleasures with life and what you're doing. And so what I find, especially with testimonials, when it comes to applied linguistics, is we're always talking about how do we get to people's stories? How do we get to know who they are and what they want? Testimonials is that spot where the testimonialist is truly giving their story. And truly, they are in charge of their story. What usually happens, let's say, for example, if you were to do a semi-structured interview where you're talking to someone about their experience, it is the interviewer who's really driving the conversation. After the conversation is over, it's the interviewer who's also filtering that conversation, deciding what's important. With a testimonial, it's a testimonialist who is driving the conversation. And in the end, the testimonialist and the person they're talking with, their voices start weaving together. So they're truly having a truly dialogic or truly involved conversation where they're creating knowledge together. And in the end, for that knowledge to be put out there into the world, they both have an ownership in deciding what gets shared, what doesn't get shared. And so that ownership is no longer the academic person coming in and saying, I'm now going to tell your story. No, with a testimonial, even though the academic, honestly, just the way the system set up, is usually the person writing it up in a journal. If you're doing a true testimonial, you've spoken with the person who gave you their story. And then once again, they have to give you permission to use their story. And in the work that I do, I go back to the youth that I work with. I'm like, hey, after our conversation, this is what I wrote up. Read this with me. What do you think? And I've had some kids like, no. This is not what I meant. This is not what I want. And then you've got to go back and change it. Because if you're truly doing testimonial work, the testimonialist, that other person you have that conversation with, they have as much ownership, if not more, over what goes out into the world. It has to be their willingness to share it. And without that, you're sort of re-inscribing these white ways of doing, which is what testimonials is all about breaking down.
No, definitely. Thank you. This is very great detail about what a testimonial is. And I really like that what you have expressed about the core concept of a testimonial is about using your voice. Let us know about your joys and pleasures of life. And I'm glad that you're saying that, because sometimes in qualitative research, you know, as a quote unquote researcher, we see our participants as objects, that you are on the other end, and you cannot tell us anything about your life or your joys or pleasures of life. And that is one of the tenets of this work, because it's a way to counter that hegemonic narrative that you're mentioning, right? I also understand that you did this work with some after school programs, right? Like a youth after school program. So I want you to let us know a little bit about what you learned from these testimonials, from these youth, and why is this so valuable?
I guess one of the things that sort of shocked me a little bit is when I went into the project, one of the things that we, and I say we as the adults in the room,
right?
We went into the project thinking, okay, you know what? In the neighborhoods where the kids live, there isn't a lot of public transportation. So we want to help them think about how to bring public transportation to their communities. Mm-hmm. And then it really came out that although public transportation was important, but there are other aspects that for the youth was even more important. For example, whenever they would think about designing the spaces in which they lived, they're all about designing communal spaces. Mm. Whether that was a soccer stadium, or whether that was a water park, or whether that was a garden space. For them, that's what was really missing, is having a space where they could be in community with each other. Mm. Or even, for example, I thought, you know, they're going to tell me in school spaces, one of the things that they wanted were fewer rules in school. But their whole thing was like, you know what? No, rules, we'd always love all of them. But what we really want, we want what they would call a chill space. So they wanted a space in school where literally they could go and be interactive with other people. So once again, the whole idea of community, of wanting to be together, because the adult narrative is all kids care about now are their cell phones and video games and things like that. And that really showed me, like, by listening to their voices, that no, they value community spaces. They value the opportunity to learn from people younger than they are. And they also value the opportunity to learn from people who are older than they are. So that sort of intergenerational space, a lot of them also really wanted. So it really came through. And then the other thing I thought was really important is with a lot of the youth with whom I work, a lot of them were underdocumented. And I say underdocumented because I don't like the word undocumented, because all of us are documented. All of us have rights. Now, do they have the documents the United States may want them to have? Maybe not. But I think there's sort of a difference there, because all of them have their documents. And one of the things they kept telling me over and over again is that that narrative that is out there about them not caring about their education, the narrative out there about, unfortunately, our former president, you know, really talking about them being rapists and murderers and bringing drugs and all that, their narrative's like, no, you know what? We work hard. We're loving. We have families who love us, that we love. So it's just all that narrative about who they were really came out. And for me, it was important. And then even when we started sort of getting into the nitty gritty, talking about language itself,
right,
having them have the opportunity to talk about and reflect on their own language and practices, for me, was fascinating. I mean, some of them would talk about, like one of the young ladies I work with, she wrote rap. You know, and she would tell me, you know what, I wrote this song, like I have this one song she wrote about promises, you know, and dreams. And in there, she has verses in there where she's really talking about what she wants out of life. And she's like, a lot of this is because I hear all these people saying that as a woman, as a girl, I can't do this, but I know I can. And so her way of using language purposely to push back on those narratives. Or to push back, she has another one she wrote about immigration. You know, pushing back on those narratives of immigration. So those are those things that usually we don't think kids think about. Mm-hmm. But through their words, through their interpretation, it was very clear that they're very cognizant and very linguistically savvy. Right. Now, did the work that I do help sort of help them grow the ways that they could talk about their language? It did.
Right.
Because, I mean, we brought in these other words, these other ways of concept that they didn't have. But what I found was, is those concepts sort of layered on top of, you want to say, with their knowledges. They just didn't have the words to talk about them the way that other people would. True. But they had the knowledge. And for me, that's what this work does. It's like it takes what they do and it values it, but it also gives them other tools they can choose to use. And to me, that's the big thing is, they can choose to use them. We're not saying you have to. We're not going to get rid of who you are. But there's some choice there.
Yeah, no, look, some of the things that I just learned from your talk is that testimonials really help us understand about those values and enhancing or amplifying the sentiments of the community. You know, the example you gave us about the chill space is because students and people out there are looking for these spaces to create community, right? And I think that's one of the sort of highlights of what a testimonial is. Now, if some of our listeners that I know are graduate students, some others are emerging scholars, they want to delve into this methodology, and because you are the expert on testimonials, I wonder if you wanna, if somebody who wants to use testimonials as a methodology, what are the things that they need to do or take into account if they were to pursue such a thing similar to the one that you did?
I think the first thing is, before you can do a testimonial or even think about it, is you need to build relationships and community. Because if you are not invited into the community, then you end up doing work on a community. So the first thing is being invited into that community. And of course, when you're invited into a community, you've got to work on building trust. And you also have to work on being humble. I mean, that's one of the things I really had to learn myself. Because you think, wow, I've got an undergraduate degree, I have a master's degree, and now I'm getting a PhD, so I must know something. But you find that when you go into a community, you don't know that much. So you've got to be humble and willing to learn from them. And then you've also got to be willing to learn with them. But my big thing is you're not going to learn on them, because that's a whole subtractive part. So to me, that's the first thing. It's building those relationships so that you're invited in, because you have to be invited in willingly, not having it imposed. The second thing is really also, you know, doing the homework. I mean, and that's really looking back and sort of looking at other folks who've written and used testimonials, whether you're looking at Dolores Delgado Bernal's work, like I mentioned, Judas Flores Carmona's work, where you're looking at the work of Lindsay Herrera Perez, or Perez Herrera. I always mix it her two last names, like put them backwards. So look at all of their work, because in the end, that work really gives you some place to start from. And then on top of that, going back, you know, and sort of doing the work of where did all this come from? What is a true testimonial? And so, and then thinking also, why do people not value them? Because when you're doing work using testimonials or practicas, which are these methodologies that have not traditionally been valued, I found it really important to know why people don't value them. And part of that is, of course, the racialization of them. Like, who's using them, what community is coming from? So knowing why. Because unfortunately, in the academy, we have to be able to speak back to those people. And we have to be able to say, hey, you know what? These are valuable for these reasons. And I can tell you why and show you how they can be used. And at the same time, being willing to sort of push against the system. Because there are some people who won't accept it no matter what. And I've come up against that. People are like, eh, you're just listening to people's stories. This isn't really important. I'm like, no. Research is all about stories. There's not a piece of research out there that isn't a narrative about someone or something. And so what better way to learn than learn with and from those who are truly involved?
I like that. I like how you ended this section about it is a way to push against the system. And I like it because in a sense, in my experience with the work that I did for my doctoral dissertation was in a similar spirit. Mm-hmm. I call it charlas and comidas, which is charlas is similar to pláticas, and pláticas and charlas are sort of similar things of having an in-depth conversation that is really meaningful for the community. Yes. And comidas for me, it was how we're going to share meals with the participants. And then by sharing and cooking with them, you know, more stories and more narratives, more juicy narratives emerge. Yes. And you won't believe that. And you were right when you said, like, a lot of traditional research, they don't like that.
No.
And we, as scholars, emerging scholars, we need to push against that system. So that's why I really like it when you mention the things that we need to take into account. And I'm just going to rephrase them. We need to build those relationships. We need to be invited to gain trust. We need to be helpful and open the space to say, how can I help? You need to be humble. Yes, I'm coming from the North. I'm coming from a North American institution. I am an academic, but how can I help? And yeah, be able to listen to what they need to say, learn with them, work with them. And one of the things that you mentioned is educate yourself. Don't just go there for the sake, oh, I'm just going to sit down and record the story, but listen and read the work that others have done before you. And overall, ask yourself where all of this is coming from. Where are you coming from? And ask all the time, why is it that you're doing this? I think that's very important. And I'm so glad that you mentioned these steps, because a lot, like I said, a lot of our listeners are, they want to make changes, but sometimes they don't know the steps of what to do and how to do them. And that's why I was so glad to have you on board today, so you can inspire our future researchers or researchers who are already there to start exploring methodologies that has been segregated for a while. And now we are sort of use them as a way to push against the system, because we deserve better. So before letting you go, is there anything that you want our audience to know about you, about the work that you do? What are you working right now in terms of teaching or research? What are your plans right now for the next semester, et cetera?
I'll be going soon at the University of Miami. So that's something coming up soon. I'll be moving down there. And one of the reasons that I accept the position there in Miami is a lot of the work that I want to be able to do, of course, is with Latinx communities, and especially with Afro-Latinx communities.
Nice.
There's a lot of work to be done there. And of course, you know, Miami's a hop, skip, and a jump, as we say, whether you're going anywhere, you know, in Latin America.
Right.
So it makes it really easy. And as I do this work, one of the things I'm also looking at is, how do we really use all of this work to begin to be truly anti-racist in our work? And I say that because a lot of times, especially now, and after everything that happened this past summer, that's become a buzzword. But I'm really working, and I really question people when they use that language. I'm like, but what exactly do you mean? And so the work I'm doing right now is even going to the curriculum level and thinking with people, okay, you're in a school and you have to teach a narrative. How do you do that in such a way so that you're truly valuing the kids that you're working with and where they're coming from? How do you do that at university and the courses that we're teaching? And so all of those things, I'm really doing a lot of work now on how do you truly do it? Not just how do you get lip service to it? And that really involves part of the conversation we've been having is truly inviting in the community into those quote unquote academic spaces. Because there's no true academic language. And I think that's the other thing that a lot of people have a problem with is because there's some value judgment going on. We're like, this is academic, so this is really important. And what you're doing, you're playing. I'm like, no, these are all equal spaces.
Right.
And how we use them to get what we need may be different. And how we remix them to get what we need. But that need comes from the community. What does the community want and need? Not what we're imposing on them. So I'm trying to do a lot more intentional work and making sure that, not that I'm giving voice to the community, because Lord knows, the folks I work with, they got a voice. They don't need me to give them voice. But what they need is for me to get out of their way and to use the privileges I have so their voices can be heard. So that's part of the research I'm doing also is how do I go about making sure that I use those doors that have been opened for me, for my communities, so that they can get what they need.
I love it. I love how you ended up the conversation today about the intentional work and also asking ourselves, I think this is important for our listeners or an audience today, ask ourselves, how can our work really be anti-racist, anti-hegemonic, anti-colonial?
Yes.
By looking at the curriculum policies, etc., and truly valuing the work that you do with others, right? And not necessarily giving them a voice, because they all have voices. It's how I can use the privilege that I have to open the spaces to those voices to be amplified.
Right.
Jason, thank you so much for coming today to Chasing Encounters podcast. I wish you the best in your in this new quote-unquote transfer to another place in which you're going to be as exciting, if not more exciting and more productive with our communities that very well deserve the work that you do. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate the time.